on Saturday, September 7th, married his betrothed on Monday at her brother's house in Troy, New York, and a week later wrote to Shapley to say he was enjoying a most wonderful and happy time on honeymoon in the Berkshires. The stock market crash of October 1929 exerted no immediate ill effects on the observatory, where the mood remained expansive through December. Shapley, having proposed Cambridge as the venue for the semi-annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society, invited the approximately 100 members into the director's residence for a New Year's Eve party. The night's entertainment cast the staff in a fully costumed and staged performance of the observatory pinafore. Book and lyrics for the operetta had been written 50 years earlier, in 1879, by former telescope assistant Winslow Upton, using music from the 1878 Gilbert and Sullivan hit about a Royal Navy ship named for a lady's apron. Upton apparently drew inspiration from the chorus of sisters, cousins, and aunts who boarded HMS Pinafore, and he turned them into a bevy of female computers for his purposes. In place of the two boy babies switched at birth, Upton twisted a zany new intrigue around a pair of prisms stolen from one of Pickering's photometers. Upton's libretto spoofed everything and everyone in the observatory. Since his stint there had overlapped Wilhelmina Fleming's clerkship prior to her son's birth, he made sure to cite our Scotch maid, who has unfortunately returned to her native land. An early scene finds young Upton, who lived in a garret off the stairway to the great refractor, ruining the noisy activities that wake him in his off hours. Arthur Searle hears him out and suggests he find a room off-site. Upton vows, I shall when my salary is large enough. To which Searle retorts, I guess you'll die of old age in that room if you wait for a large salary before giving it up. For all that had changed at the observatory since Upton's day, the wages of astronomy remained an evergreen theme. The point was driven further home in the lyrics, an astronomer is a sorry soul, as free as a caged bird. His sympathetic ear should be always quick to hear the directorial word. He must open the dome and turn the wheel and watch the stars with untiring zeal. He must toil at night, though cold it be, and he never should expect a decent salary. The current crew enjoyed reviving all the ghosts of New Year's past, especially the gentlemanly Pickering, whose strongest oath when provoked to anger in the drama is, O Polaris! At an encore performance on Monday, January 13th, for the monthly meeting of the Bond Astronomical Club, half again as many guests squeezed into the director's residence. After that night, Shapley pledged with mock solemnity, We resume our sober and methodical attempts to maintain the scientific standing of the observatory. Foreigners now looked on Harvard as the meeting place of the astronomers of the world. They deemed its multinational character unusual, even in the decidedly international science of astronomy. Shapley was happy to receive Svein Roseland from Norway in 1930 and Ernst Epic from Estonia, even though, as he half-joked to George Agassiz, it was difficult finding places for our present staff and scientific visitors to sit down. The workforce had about trebled in size over the course of his directorship. A cloud darkened Shapley's horizon in the form of interstellar obscuration. In the spring of 1930, Robert J. Trumpler of the Lick Observatory in California produced proof that the Milky Way teemed with dust. Trumpler, who had once collected ants for Shapley in Australia, now showed that invisible particulates permeated the galaxy. The intruding dust undermined almost all determinations of magnitude, and likewise the distances deduced from magnitudes. Trumpler came to these conclusions by observing 100 open clusters, close associations of stars that were not as densely crowded together as in globular clusters. He calculated each open cluster's distance two ways, by its apparent brightness and also its apparent diameter. Both values predictably decreased with distance. But the open clusters faded in brightness much faster than they shrank in size. Some form of dark matter definitely intervened to absorb their light. As far as Trumpler could tell, the mysterious absorbing medium was confined to the Milky Way, but unevenly distributed. It concentrated along the plane of the galaxy and dissipated near the poles. Shapley had banked on transparency when he estimated the galaxy's extent at 300,000 light years. With the effect of interstellar absorption factored in, the Milky Way contracted to about half that size. This was a sharp rebuff to Shapley's ideas, Miss Sawyer observed, and he felt it deeply. Still, he wanted to inform the observatory community of the news. Miss Sawyer said he asked her to review Trumpler's paper for a colloquium, knowing, I think, that my empathy for the situation would lead me to deal with it as unabrasively as possible. That presentation was her last at Harvard. In September, she and Frank Hogg got married at her family home in Lowell, Massachusetts, with most of the observatory family as witnesses. The couple set up housekeeping in South Hadley, near their new workplaces, she as assistant to Professor Ann Sewell Young at Mount Holyoke, with time off to write her dissertation on globular clusters, and he as a researcher assigned to the 18-inch telescope at Amherst College. Margaret Walton, the Swarthmore graduate and former Pickering Fellow who now served as Miss Cannon's recorder, married R. Newton Mayle, a landscape architect and amateur variable star observer. She had met him while assisting Margaret Harwood one summer on Nantucket. Miss Walton, however, retained her position at the Harvard Observatory, and also the use of her maiden name. Marriage no longer spelled the end of a career for a woman astronomer, as it had when Miss Cannon entered the field. She approved of the new trend and defended the rights of all her Pickering Fellow brides. Does it not appear that research, which is not confined to fixed hours or necessarily to office walls, may easily be carried on by married women? She asked rhetorically in one of her regular reports as chairman of Nantucket's Astronomical Fellowship Committee. A stellar photograph may be studied at home during odd hours and perhaps may not require more time from a wife or mother than is frequently given to bridge playing or various other social activities. Solon Bailey spent 6 years writing The History and Work of Harvard Observatory, 1839 to 1927. The completed volume was published as a Harvard monograph early in 1931. Only a few months later, on June 5th, Bailey died of a short, sudden illness at his summer home in Norwell. His wife and son were with him. The bereaved Miss Cannon borrowed a line from Julius Caesar for her friend's obituary. His life was gentle. Having known Bailey for 30 years, she could honestly report in the publications of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, "He won the respect of all by his wide sympathy, his justice, his never-failing kindness, and his complete lack of self-seeking." Bailey's other good friend and colleague, Edward King, wrote a separate obituary for publication in Popular Astronomy. Before that story had a chance to appear, however, King himself fell ill and died on September 10th, just 10 days after he retired. Miss Payne, who had grown close to King through their shared passion for collecting old classical texts, wrote a tribute to him in a subsequent issue of Popular Astronomy. She quoted a letter that King had received from Bailey the previous spring, when both men were reminiscing over their long careers in astronomy. "To have done work which is widely recognized, to have gained the sincere esteem of many and the real love of even a few, surely these are sufficient reasons to look on life as well worth the living." Despite the depression, Shapley added more than $1 million in gifts and bequests to the observatory's endowment in 1931, most of it from the Rockefeller Foundation. Construction began in July on a bigger brick building, adjacent to the old one, with all the latest innovations in fireproof protections, plus room for the plate collection's projected growth over the next 50 years. In October, Shapley announced that several of the photographic telescopes would soon move from Observatory Hill to a secluded spot in the woods northwest of Cambridge, near the village of Harvard, Massachusetts. Stands of maple, oak, pine, and birch at the new site, called Oak Ridge, would shelter the instruments from wind, soot, and the plague of artificial light. Shapley also made public his plan to install a 60-inch reflector, a northern counterpart to the one being built for Bloemfontein at Oak Ridge. The sylvan 30 acres would soon boast the best-equipped observing station in the eastern United States. Shapley's contributions to astronomical science had recently won him the National Academy of Sciences Medal, perpetuating the name of Dr. Henry Draper. The small elite fraternity of Draper Medal winners included Edward Pickering, George Ellery Hale, Henry Norris Russell, and Arthur Stanley Eddington. Shapley thought the time ripe to add a woman's name to that roster, and he submitted his nomination in support of Miss Cannon. Her life's work under the auspices of the memorial founded by the founder of the medal is drawing to a close. Shapley wrote to the members of the Academy's Draper Fund Committee, "It is needless to comment on the nature and permanence of her contribution. She was the one who had put the classification system into its current popular form, and she alone had passed judgment on each of its 250,000 stars. The Henry Draper catalog, as far as I remember, has never received any official recognition in the United States by medal, vote, honorary degree, or otherwise," Shapley continued. "Miss Cannon is quite indifferent to such recognition, but it strikes me that the work she has done is the greatest contribution to science enabled by the Drapers, and that there is a certain appropriateness in considering Miss Cannon for the medal." The committee concurred. Shapley, in his glee, prepared a private citation in advance of the official one yet to come. His read as follows. "Dr. Annie Jump Cannon. The benign presence of the brick building, noted collector of degrees and medals, author of 9 immortal volumes and several thousand oatmeal cookies, Virginia Reeler, bridge player, and the godmother of S.W. Andromedy, and especially the recipient of the Draper Medal of the National Academy of Sciences, the first medal ever bestowed on a woman by that honorable body of fossils, and one of the highest honors attainable by astronomers of any sex, race, religious, or political preference. In recognition of this great honor, indicated by the Draper Medal and on behalf of the staff of the Harvard Observatory, I anoint you with the usual stardust, present you with the metagalactic emblem of good luck, and drape you with this token of becoming the world's jolliest Draper medalist." Chapter 14. Miss Cannon's Prize. The upcoming festivities at the observatory promise to be Harlow and Martha Shapley's biggest party ever, the Triennial General Assembly of the International Astronomical Union, scheduled for September 1932. When he invited the IAU to Harvard, the director begged to let 4 years instead of the usual 3, just this once, elapse between meetings. The delay would enable an entertainment comparable to that at past receptions in the capitals of Europe, where potentates of church and state had presided over opulent ceremonies. In place of those trappings, the more homespun Harvard General Assembly promised the natural miracle of a total solar eclipse. Shortly before 4 o'clock local time on Wednesday afternoon, August 31st, 1932, the moon would obliterate the sun, and the skies over New England would go dark. The visiting astronomers could distribute themselves along the path of totality from Quebec through parts of Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts, then pack up their equipment and repair to Cambridge. Shapley's plan entailed a big risk of bad weather. The available predictions gave only a 50-50 chance of ideal observing conditions on eclipse day, and failed eclipse expeditions would surely pitch the astronomers into gloom. Even Miss Cannon had turned sour, briefly, when cloud cover cheated her out of photographing the flash spectrum during the 1923 eclipse in Southern California. Nevertheless, the director banked on success. He put the first graduate student, Adelaide Ames, now his sidekick in galactic exploration, in charge of hospitality arrangements for the IAU. In May 1932, as the time of the assembly neared, Shapley and Miss Ames were wrapping up their extensive, definitive survey of external galaxies. They had looked at more than 1,000 island universes contained in the Harvard Plate Collection. They had classified the shapes of these nebulae, 700 of which were spirals, and computed the total brightness of each according to a uniform system of photometric magnitudes. The Shapley-Ames catalog showed, for the first time, the distribution of such objects over the entire sky. Although Shapley's picture of the Milky Way still lacked detail, he and Miss Ames had taken steps toward tracking the contours of the larger cosmos. It was larger than they imagined, and apparently growing larger all the time. As early as 1914, Vesto Melvin Slipher of the Lowell Observatory in Arizona had shown the spectra of most spiral nebulae to be shifted toward the red, meaning they were receding along the line of sight, rushing away at high speed. Later, Edwin Hubble at Mount Wilson built on Slipher's findings. By painstakingly approximating the distances to the fleeing spirals, he perceived a new relationship, dubbed Hubble's Law. The farther the galaxy, the faster it fled. In late June, after Miss Ames had left the text and tables of the Shapley-Ames catalog with the college printer, she set off with a few of her observatory co-workers for a short vacation at Squam Lake, near Holderness, New Hampshire. The family of her friend Mary Allen owned a rustic lakeside camp there with panoramic views of the White Mountains. On Sunday the 26th, Miss Ames and Miss Allen paddled a canoe out to the center of the lake, where a squall struck and capsized them. They laughed over the mishap at first, while trying to right the canoe. Then they abandoned ship and swam for shore. Both young women were strong swimmers, but when Mary, in the lead, reached the shallows and looked back over her shoulder, there was no one behind her. She called out to Adelaide a few times. She screamed for help. Others rushed to the scene and made repeated dives at the spot where the hysterical survivor had last seen her companion's head above water. They could find no sign of her. Someone had to telephone Colonel Thales L. Ames, commanding officer of the Springfield Armory, to inform him that his 32-year-old daughter had apparently suffered a cramp while swimming and drowned. When the news reached Shapley on Monday, he closed the observatory and drove to the lake with Leon Campbell to assist Colonel Ames. Police were there, directing search parties on foot and in small craft. Airplanes skimmed over the lake in circles until dark. On Tuesday, Miss Cannon wrote in her diary, "Adelaide's body not found yet." It took more than a week to recover her remains. During the funeral service at Christ Church, Cambridge, on July 7th, Miss Cannon said it broke her heart to look at Colonel and Mrs. Ames. The following day, they buried their daughter, their only child, in Arlington National Cemetery. The traditional barring of women from careers in most fields of science led, in 1897, to the founding of a small organization centered in Boston called the Association to Aid Scientific Research by Women. In its early years, the group's sole function was to raise funds in support of a research table for American ladies at the Zoological Station in Naples, Italy, where Professor Anton Dorn extended a Pickering-esque welcome to female researchers. Within a few years, the association broadened its mandate to award grants to individual scientists, and later a prize, the Ellen Richards Research Prize, recognizing lifetimes of accomplishment. The award honored the late Ellen Swallow Richards, a chemist and charter member of the association who had been the first woman admitted as a full-time student to MIT. She established the Women's Laboratory at the Institute in 1876, and after several years of teaching with neither salary nor title, she became Assistant Professor of Chemical Analysis, Industrial Chemistry, Mineralogy, and Applied Biology. Even then, she was given no compensation. But as a married woman, the wife of Robert Hallowell Richards, head of mining engineering at MIT, she could afford to work without pay. The Association to Aid Scientific Research by Women awarded the 1932 Ellen Richards Research Prize of $1,000 to two worthy recipients. Dr. Helen Dean King, a biologist at the Wistar Institute of the University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Annie Jump Cannon of the Harvard College Observatory. With that decision, the 12 members declared themselves satisfied with the progress they had seen, and they drafted a resolution to dissolve the organization. Whereas, it said, the objects for which this association has worked for 35 years have been achieved, since women are given opportunities in scientific research on an equality with men, and to gain recognition for their achievements, be it resolved that this association cease to exist after the adjournment of this meeting. An outside observer might have judged the association's dissolution premature. Miss Cannon seemed to think so, as she moved to extend its good works. Your letter concerning the Ellen Richards Research Prize is of great interest, she replied to Marjorie Nicholson, Dean of Students at Smith College on June 10, 1932. And the enclosed check is certainly a delightful recognition of my many years of astronomical investigation. She felt doubly grateful, she said, because she had known the prize's namesake, and recalled several conversations with Mrs. Richards at the College Club of Boston and at meetings of the Association of Collegiate Alumni concerning opportunities for women. I wish I might convey through you to the committee, Miss Cannon continued, to the donors and to all the members of the former Association to Aid Scientific Research by Women, my very great appreciation of this prize. I hope to use it to advance in some way astronomical research by women. Moreover, the very thought of it will be a constant spur for increased efforts on my part towards the completion of the various problems which I have underway, realizing that the faith of so many representative women demands a justification in the highest service which it is possible for one to give. Miss Cannon earmarked her $1,000 bounty to endow the Annie Jump Cannon Prize. She wished it to be awarded biennially or triennially by the American Astronomical Society to a deserving woman of any nationality. It would take time, she knew, for interest on the seed money to grow into a substantial purse, but she did not want to put off the first award indefinitely. She was nearly 70 years old and determined to confer the Cannon Prize in person at least once while still in good health. She thought she might enhance the cash value with a feminine token of some kind, a brooch or a necklace in a starry motif, which could be kept as a memento and worn long after the money had been spent. She began searching for a craftswoman who could fabricate the item she had in mind. Not only astronomers flocked to the Northeast for the total eclipse of August 31st, 1932, wide publicity turned the event into a popular tourist attraction. And although most scientists who made observations were looking at the sky, a few measured the eclipse's effect on terrestrial phenomena, such as radio transmissions and animal behavior. William Morton Wheeler, the Harvard myrmecologist, had read historical reports of ants that ceased all activity during eclipses, as though transfixed by the sudden midday darkness. Wheeler felt certain the ants were reacting to the rapid drop in temperature, not the absence of light. Eager to learn more, he put out a call for voluntary reports from interested parties. Field observation on insect behavior is, of course, difficult during a total eclipse. Wheeler conceded in the Proceedings of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, because the observer is apt to be very desirous of witnessing at the same time a wonderful astronomical event, which he may never again be able to contemplate. Still, Wheeler hoped that entomologists would forego gaping skyward to look down and amass basic information that could be tested further during future eclipses. Even the astronomers, he said, had to learn what to expect during a total eclipse before they could make elaborate preparation beforehand. True to form, astronomers geared up for the occasion. A full boatload of instrumentation from the Royal Observatory, including a 45-foot-long telescope, sailed from Greenwich on July 13th to ensure the accompanying scientists ample time for assembly and practice on site. Those who planned on just seeing the eclipse as opposed to observing it could afford to arrive at the last moment. In August, a consortium of Canadian astronomers descended on Louisville, Quebec, to array their instruments on the local fairgrounds, where they encountered the French expedition and the eclipse party of the American Amateur Astronomical Association of New York. All three groups enjoyed optimal conditions and met most of their observing goals during the 101 seconds of totality. Only 25 miles to the north at Saint-Alexis-des-Monts, as luck would have it, an equipment-laden encampment that had been set up weeks in advance suffered an invasion of clouds and could not move out from under them. Similarly, a group in Gorham, New Hampshire, reported complete failure due to weather, although four members of that team managed to snatch a clear view of totality through a gap in the clouds by driving 30 miles eastward in a fast car. The other partners stayed put and carried out their fully rehearsed program regardless, on the off chance that the clouds might part in mid-eclipse, though that did not happen. Overall, only a fortunate few of the researchers won the eclipse day gamble. These included the several Harvard parties, especially the principal one stationed at West Grey, Maine. At a spot near West Acton, Massachusetts, someone noticed a nuptial flight of ants emerging from the soil to mate in midair, a behavior known to be cued by falling temperature. Many of the nearly 200 delegates to the Cambridge IAU meeting swapped eclipse stories as they gathered on Saturday, September 3rd, for the start of ceremonies at Alice Longfellow Hall in the Radcliffe Yard. Bernice V. Brown, the dean of Radcliffe College, could not resist dropping an eclipse allusion in her opening address. "We are used to welcoming students to the college who come here looking at the world through rose-colored glasses," she said. "But this is the first time we have had visitors with smoked glasses." The students were all absent on summer holiday, freeing the lecture halls and dormitories for the astronomers' use. Dean Brown said she hoped some of the guests would return another time when classes were in session. "The Harvard Observatory," she acknowledged, "has not only been ready and willing to give instruction to the Radcliffe girls, but they have fostered a long line of graduate students. We are delighted to show hospitality to their colleagues." Sir Frank Dyson, Astronomer Royal of Great Britain and current president of the IAU, thanked Dean Brown and saluted Charles Francis Adams, the Secretary of the Navy, who conveyed official greetings from President Herbert Hoover. Turning to Shapley, Sir Frank recalled an earlier visit. "In 1910, on the way to the Solar Union at Mount Wilson, we saw the many activities in which Professor Pickering was engaged. We are all delighted to come again. We are glad to see the pleasant face of Miss Cannon once more. We are all delighted to see the Harvard Observatory and all the activities in which you are engaged, especially your researches on the Milky Way." Addressing the full audience, Sir Frank welcomed one and all, with special reference to the representatives from Germany and Austria, whose countries were not yet officially connected to the Union. Then he asked the assembly to stand as he recited the names of the 22 IAU members who had died since the Leiden meeting. "Some of these," Sir Frank said, "like Monsieur Bigourdan, Father Hagen, and Dr. Noble, have died in the fullness of years. But others, like Monsieur Andoyer, General Ferrier, and Professor Turner, we hoped to have with us for many more years, and we can ill spare them. We particularly wish to express our sympathy to Professor Shapley and the staff of the Harvard Observatory on the tragic death of their gifted and charming colleague, Miss Adelaide Ames, who was the secretary of the local committee charged with the preparations for this meeting. We are mindful of the services to astronomy of all those we have lost, and we shall keep them in affectionate memory." The death of Miss Ames devastated her heavenly twin, Cecilia Payne. Miss Payne had been among the invited guests at Squam Lake and could not bear to speak of what had happened there. One day she bumped into an acquaintance who, having heard a bungled account of the accident, blurted out, "Why, I heard you had been drowned." To which Miss Payne confessed that she wished it were true, and that the lake had claimed her life instead of Miss Ames. In the aftermath, Miss Payne compared herself, absorbed in my work, shy and unattractive, with the other twin, whom she idolized as beautiful, outgoing, and beloved by everyone. Miss Payne resolved to try giving more of herself in the future, to embrace life and do my part as a human being. Open and vulnerable, she fell in love for the first time. Unreasonably, groundlessly, but nonetheless thoroughly, for I am nothing if not thorough, she wrote in her memoir. It did not take me long to see that my love was not, never would be reciprocated, and I fell into a state of despair. Priscilla and Bart Bock buoyed her through the dark hours, encouraging her to go away for a while. She took their advice and planned an extended trip to visit the observatories of Northern Europe. In the summer of 1933, Miss Payne traveled to Leiden, Copenhagen, Lund, Stockholm, Helsinki, and the historic Tartu Observatory with its 9-inch refractor built by Joseph von Fraunhofer in Estonia. Everywhere she went, she was welcomed and indulged. At the IAU meeting in Cambridge the previous summer, she had renewed her friendship with Boris Gerasimovich, who invited her to visit him at Pulkova. Once in Europe, however, other hosts tried to persuade her to skip the Russian leg of her journey, as did the American consul in Estonia. The United States had no diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union, the official told her, and would not be able to help her out of any difficulties she might encounter there. But Miss Payne did not heed these entreaties. She meant to honor her promise to Gerasimovich. Miss Payne found herself alone on the train after it crossed the Russian border. At Leningrad, Gerasimovich came to meet her with a driver in a pickup truck. But since it was illegal for three to ride in the front seat, she had to sit on the floor of the truck bed all the way to the observatory. "I spent 2 weeks at Pulkova," she recorded, "and felt I had experienced a lifetime. The atmosphere of tension never lifted. It was not only the drab and squalid living conditions of the man who was the director of one of the great observatories. It was not only the scarcity of food, for food was severely rationed, and they shared their rations with me. I had brought them some coffee, and they gave a party to celebrate it. Nobody there had tasted coffee for several years. One day there was a special treat for supper, carrots, and my host confessed that he had stolen them from a neighboring garden. Small wonder that the food nearly choked me. Unappetizing as it was, I was taking it from their plates. Everyone was afraid to talk lest they should be overheard. One of the young women led me to the middle of a wide field and begged me in a whisper to help her go abroad. I would wash dishes, she said. I would do anything to get away from here. And what could I do? What could I possibly have done? I was appalled. Miss Payne lost all sense of personal grief in those grim surroundings. She felt as though she were holding her breath for the duration of her stay, and she carried that sense of oppression away with her on the train ride to Germany. In Göttingen in August, still shaken, she attended the meeting of the Astronomische Gesellschaft held at the Mathematics Institute. She spotted her mentor, Eddington, there, but dared not try to attach herself to his distinguished circle. Instead, she took a seat by herself in the rear of the large auditorium. A young stranger of about her own age sat down near her, asking in German, "Are you Miss Payne?" He introduced himself as Sergei Ilarionovich Kapushkin. He had ridden a bicycle from Potsdam to the meeting, 150 miles, in hopes of finding her, he said. And he gave her an autobiographical sketch that explained his desperate situation. She read it that night, in lieu of sleep. Kapushkin was a Russian emigre facing Nazi persecution. As one of 10 children born to poor parents in the Crimean village of Yevpatoria, he had worked on fishing boats, farms, and in factories to realize his childhood dream of becoming an astronomer. He had studied in Bulgaria and Berlin and written a doctoral dissertation about eclipsing binary stars, in which he cited papers by both Harlow Shapley and Cecilia Payne. Just recently, he had lost his job at the Babelsberg Observatory for political reasons. Kapushkin was under suspicion in Germany of being a Soviet spy and had been denied re-entry into Russia, where authorities presumed him a German spy. Of course, I knew I must help him to escape the last of the many disasters that had overtaken him, Miss Payne realized. When I saw him the next day, I told him that I could make no promises, but I would do what I could. Kapushkin's first sight of Miss Payne surprised him, he later wrote, because he had expected her to be as old as the famed Harvard astronomer Annie Jump Cannon. Her youth and bearing put him in mind of a ripe peach left alone on a tree, darkened, wrinkled a little outside, but the more delicious inside. Miss Payne found it relatively easy to convince Shapley of the need to rescue Kapushkin. Since the early 1920s, the director had been engaged in various efforts to aid Russian astronomers affected by war, revolution, and civil strife. Yes, Shapley said, they would make room for Kapushkin at Harvard. But how to get him there? He was stateless and destitute. Miss Payne, who had become a naturalized United States citizen in 1931, went to Washington to expedite the granting of a visa to a man without a country. On Sunday, November 26, 1933, Kapushkin sailed into Boston Harbor, and Miss Payne met his ship at the pier. She drove the new arrival to the apartment she had found for him in Cambridge, then took him to meet Shapley and the rest of the observatory staff that same evening at a party in the director's residence. Given that Kapushkin spoke very little English, Miss Payne continued to converse with him in German. They had almost constant occasion to speak to each other, as he was assigned to work under her direct supervision on the new photometric standards. Even his one-year salary of $800 came out of the funding for her project. Their familiarity bred affection. After 3 months of working together, they eloped to New York and were married in City Hall on March 5, 1934. Shapley, informed in advance of their plans, facilitated the wedding through New York friends, who not only served as witnesses at the ceremony, but also treated the couple to a nuptial luncheon of champagne and caviar. The next day, the bride wrote to Shapley from the Hotel Woodstock, "I had never thought that such happiness could be for me." Shapley broke the news of the Payne-Kapushkin marriage to the observatory community during one of his hollow squares. These informal meetings took place weekly in the library of the newly expanded brick building. They got their name from the temporary rearrangement of the reading tables into a rectangle, with the chairs ranged around the outside so that all participants could face one another. Shapley used the hollow squares, renamed Harlow Squares by the graduate students, to share research developments at other observatories, introduce visiting astronomers, and give the Harvard staff a forum for reporting their own progress or suggesting new ideas. Apparently, no one had noticed the romance blossoming between Miss Payne and her Russian research assistant, for the general reaction was one of shock, even outrage. Why, aside from being two lonely astronomers in their mid-30s, the pair had absolutely nothing in common. And what's more, Cecilia, at 5'10", stood half a head taller than her new husband, who had no prospects and precious little to offer her, so far as anyone could tell. The passage of time embellished the story of the wedding announcement at the Hollow Square. People liked to say that Miss Cannon reacted by fainting dead away, but of course she did nothing of the kind. The union of two scientists, she knew, could produce a whole greater than the sum of its components. Single or married, Cecilia was still her top pick for the first Annie Jump Cannon Prize, to be awarded at the December 1934 meeting of the American Astronomical Society, AAS, in Philadelphia. It just so happened that the current president and first vice president of the society were men particularly important to the winner's career, Henry Norris Russell and Harlow Shapley. The interest earned on Miss Cannon's $1,000 principal amounted to an inaugural prize of only $50. However, she had located an able jeweler, Marjorie Blackman, to fashion the desired gold pin in the form of a spiral nebula. After a few tries in silver, Miss Blackman, who was new to astronomy, mastered the nebular proportions, smoothed an area on the back for engraving, and attached a loop that allowed the pin to be worn also as a pendant on a chain. Miss Cannon was pleased. "I think it is quite pretty," she wrote to AAS Secretary Raymond Smith Dugan shortly before the meeting. "Isn't it the first universe ever made by a woman?" At the banquet on December 28, Russell presented the award to Mrs. Gaposchkin for her valuable work in interpreting stellar spectra. She gave a brief acceptance speech and then invited Miss Cannon to make a few anecdotal remarks on the preparation of the Henry Draper catalog. More and more these days, Miss Cannon was called upon to share her memories. Her recorder, Margaret Walton, had taken to typing up some of the anecdotes and filing them in folders with labels such as Under Southern Stars and Old Dover Days. Miss Cannon remembered some details from childhood as clearly as she recalled her stellar classifications. "In the house where I was born," she dictated to Miss Walton, "there stood on the white marble mantel a candelabra representing a gilded tree. At the base, two children are about to waken a sleeping huntsman. Five outspreading branches support the candles, which are surrounded by glass prismatic pendants. I remember no earlier plaything than these prisms, which were easily detachable. To hold one in my hands, to catch a sunbeam and watch the brilliant prismatic colors dance over the wall, was a delight to my youthful eyes. Even now, I hold one of these pendants in my hands and note that it is embossed with stars. Stars and prisms." How prophetic was this baby amusement of the profession which was destined to fill my life. Miss Cannon continued to classify ever fainter stars with gusto, but publication lagged on account of budget shortfalls. In 1937, Shapley solved the problem by changing the format. In place of the tabular rows and columns of digits typical of the Henry Draper catalog and the early installments of the Henry Draper extension, the new Henry Draper charts were presented as reproductions of photographic plates. On these plates, Miss Cannon numbered the spectra and designated the class letter for each, and sometimes assessed the magnitude as well. Every annotated picture thus compressed several hundred stars' worth of data. Assistants no longer needed to list the individual star alongside its other catalog designations, or describe its position in declination and right ascension. These shortcuts saved so many pages of type that 5 to 10 times the number of spectra could be published annually. There was no need for Miss Cannon to slow down. Along with her classifying, Miss Cannon also kept up her bibliography pertaining to variable star observations. The 15,000 index cards she inherited in 1900 had since multiplied many times over, and now numbered around 200,000. She maintained as well a much smaller collection of astronomical verse, poems by Milton, Longfellow, Tennyson, and others, within the covers of a slim notebook. She liked these lines from Ralph Waldo Emerson's Nature well enough to transcribe them. "Teach me your mood, O patient stars, who climb each night the ancient sky, leaving on space no shade, no scars, no trace of age, no fear to die." Now in her 70s, Miss Cannon still reported to the observatory 6 days a week. Every spring, she selected a new Pickering Fellow and a new recipient for financial aid from Nantucket nonagenarian Lydia Hinchman. The fresh faces of the incoming young ladies had gradually replaced the long familiar ones. Florence Cushman retired in 1937 after 49 years of computing, proofreading, and assisting Willard Gerrish, who soon followed her. Lillian Hodgden, the assistant curator of the photographic library, left at the end of half a century's service. Miss Hodgden's title, like Miss Cannon's, was an observatory honorific, not a university position. In January 1938, however, 5 years after James B. Conant succeeded Abbot Lawrence Lowell as president, the Harvard Corporation officially recognized Miss Cannon as the William Cranch Bond Astronomer and Curator of Astronomical Photographs. In the same stroke, the corporation reversed the discrimination against Mrs. Gaposchkin by naming her the Phillips Astronomer. "Gosh," Observatory Secretary Arville Walker exclaimed in an in-house broadside announcing the twin events. "For the first time in its 301 glorious years, the Corporation of Harvard University has deliberately recognized women academically by these appointments. It is an occasion. Let's celebrate with a Dutch treat luncheon. Commander Hotel, Tuesday, January 18th, 12:30, 85 cents. Please report your plans promptly to Miss Walker." Fully 50 well-wishers showed up. In her excitement, Miss Walker had slightly overstated the nature of the honors done to Miss Cannon and Mrs. Gaposchkin. While their new titles had indeed been granted by the corporation and approved by the Board of Overseers, they were not exactly academic. Miss Cannon was to continue as before, in a post now glorified by association with the name of founding observatory director William Cranch Bond. The Phillips name, as in Phillips Astronomer, had also been attached to the institution since its infancy. Edward Bromfield Phillips, a Harvard classmate and close friend of Bond's son George, had willed his family fortune of $100,000 to the observatory shortly before he killed himself in 1848. At the age of 23. William Cranch Bond consequently became the first Phillips professor, followed by his successors, George Phillips Bond and Joseph Winlock. In Pickering's day, the bequest of an even larger fortune changed the director's title to Payne Professor, in memory of benefactor Robert Treat Payne. At that point, the Phillips professorship devolved on Arthur Searle and passed to Solon Bailey after Searle officially retired in 1912. Now that the Phillips title belonged to Mrs. Gaposchkin, It gained her a listing in the Harvard catalog as an officer of the university. Shapley hoped it would do yet more. In pressing for her appointment as the Phillips astronomer, he had needed to assure the corporation that conferring the title on a woman would not make her a member of the college faculty or even of the astronomy department. Meanwhile, Shapley confided to President Conant, "At some future time, if the university approves the policy, I should like to recommend that the title be changed to Phillips Professor of Astronomy." After all, she was already teaching and directing graduate research, sitting on 3 IAU commissions, and enjoying an international reputation as an astrophysicist, spectroscopist, and photometrist. She was also the mother of 2 children. Edward, named for her father, was born May 29, 1935, and Catherine on January 25, 1937. The Kapochkins had bought a house in Lexington on a large lot, where they cleared the yard of rocks and brambles to make room for flowers and trees. The Annie Jump Cannon Prize, awarded every 3 years by the Executive Council of the American Astronomical Society, increased gradually in cash value over time. In 1937, it went to Charlotte Moore Sitterly, who was Henry Norris Russell's personal computer. With each new winner, Miss Cannon gave a new craftswoman the chance to create her own decorative universe in jewelry. The 1940 prize recognized Julie Vinter Hansen of the Copenhagen University's Østervold Observatory, an expert on calculating orbits for comets and asteroids. Although Miss Vinter Hansen was working in the United States at the time of the award presentation, she could not leave Berkeley to attend the banquet, being held once again in Philadelphia. As soon as the check and accompanying token reached her by mail in January 1941, she wrote to thank Miss Cannon. "The medal has now arrived, and to my pleasant surprise, it is no medal at all. I love this feminine touch that it has taken the form of a pin that can be worn every day. I think it is very beautiful, and it has been on my dress ever since it came. Also yesterday, when I was radio interviewed in Oakland and had an occasion to tell how grateful I am to this country and its astronomers, an occasion that was so much more welcome to me, as I missed the opportunity to express what is in my heart by not being able to go to Philadelphia." In the next breath, Miss Vinter Hansen asked, "Why do you not come out to California and its wonderful climate this winter? I know the astronomers would be delighted to welcome you." Miss Cannon declined, too taken up with activities to consider the trip. "Last Saturday, I gave a broadcast by shortwave on the story of starlight," she told her Oxford pen pal, Daisy Turner, the widow of Herbert Hall Turner, on January 21st. "Dr. Shapley was sick in bed with flu and heard it horizontally," he said. "He spoke a good word for it, which pleased me greatly. There is something uncanny about speaking to such a hypothetical audience. Do you recall the Bond Club? It still goes on, and I am heading a course in astronomical reading for a group meeting me in a fortnight. I am just as busy as a bee with many interesting things outside. My dear neighbor, Ruth Munn, was just in talking about the Cambridge Historical Society meeting to be held in her home next week. She wants me to wear my best evening gown." The 1941 IAU General Assembly, originally planned for Zurich in August, had already been canceled owing to the alarming escalation of aggression in Europe. "Oh, I do hope Oxford will not be harmed," Miss Cannon worried to Mrs. Turner. "It is all so merciless, horrible, and unbelievable." Not to dwell on war, Miss Cannon turned to other news of mutual friends and mundane events. "We are having cold weather, but crystal clear, brilliant sunshine, invigorating air. It is bracing, and I feel fit." She closed with, "Love again and again, AJC. She continued to work and feel well until mid-March, when her health took a turn. After a few weeks, the illness grew serious enough to send her to the Cambridge Hospital, where she died on Easter Sunday. On the 13th of April, 1941, Cecilia Payne-Gaposchkin reported in Science, "The world lost a great scientist and a great woman. Astronomy lost a distinguished contributor, and countless human beings lost a beloved friend by the death of Miss Annie J. Kennan." Cecilia could remember the day, not so long ago, when she and Sergei invited the whole staff out to Lexington, to what would have been a garden party if not for the torrents of rain, and how Annie had breezed in, full of cheer, wearing a bright flowered dress, and hoping that her outfit might do something to counteract the weather. Although Miss Cannon was well into her eighth decade at the end of her life, it could still be said that she had died young. "During the past year," Shapley wrote in his 1941 annual report, "the observatory suffered a heavy loss through the death of Miss Annie Jump Cannon. In her 77th year, Miss Cannon was still engaged in classifying the spectra of the stars, work in which she was a pioneer and which she had carried on for more than 40 years. During that interval, the spectra of about 500,000 stars passed under her scrutiny. In addition to the results published in the Henry Draper Catalog and the Henry Draper Extension, she had classified approximately 100,000 stars, unpublished at the time of her death. To commemorate the life and work of this gentlewoman, whose kindly advice, enthusiasm, and perseverance charmed and encouraged all who met her, the observatory has planned a series of memorials. A memorial volume of the Annals, to contain the 100,000 unpublished spectra, will soon be issued. The expense of this volume has already been met through the generosity of her friend, Professor James R. Jewett, Emeritus Professor of Arabic in Harvard University. Two endowed fellowships in the observatory are contemplated as a further memorial. They would continue to offer the inspiration of Miss Cannon's example to young men and women interested in undertaking the career of astronomical research. One would be available to students from Wellesley College, Miss Cannon's alma mater, and would be awarded with preference to students from Delaware, her native state. The office in which Miss Cannon worked has been set aside as a memorial room and will soon be redecorated in an appropriate manner. The type of work that she did will be carried on in this room and in the others that she used. Chapter 15. The Lifetimes of Stars. Cecilia and Sergei Gaposchkin had the observatory almost to themselves throughout the war years of the 1940s. Often they brought their children to work, letting them sled down the steep slope of Observatory Hill or play hide-and-seek in the dusty catacomb under the great refractor. The couple had a third child now, Peter, born April 5th, 1940. They also owned, in addition to their house on Shade Street in Lexington, a small farm near Townsend, where a neighbor helped them raise pigs and poultry for local markets. As naturalized U.S. citizens, they considered their farm labor a patriotic duty, and they delivered their meat and eggs by horse and buggy to conserve their allotment of rationed gasoline. In 1942, when Japanese Americans on the West Coast were forced to enter internment camps, the Gaposchkins took in the family of Reverend Caspar Horikoshi, whose son and daughter were playmates of Edward and Catherine. To increase their own and others' understanding of the global crisis, the Gaposchkins set up a discussion group called the Forum for International Problems. It met one evening every other week in the observatory library, with Shapley's hearty approval. Speakers came from all departments of the university, as well as the Boston and Cambridge communities. In her role as chairman, Mrs. Gaposchkin tried not to take sides, particularly, she said, when participants urged their arguments with intemperate zeal. At times, she feared the disputes on the platform would lead to physical violence. From Cambridge to Oak Ridge to Bloemfontein, young men dispersed to the branches of the armed forces. Staff members were stunned, Shapley noted, to discover how well their training and practice in astronomy had fitted them for effective cooperation in the war effort. After all, sailors needed to steer by the stars, and an astronomer's lenses, mirrors, and photographic techniques lent themselves readily to strategic purposes. The director informed President Conant in autumn 1942 that 25 of his subordinates were engaged in 11 distinct types of military research, some of which were too confidential for comment. Mrs. Shapley was working for the Navy, calculating ballistics trajectories. Frances Wright, one of the younger generation of computers, devoted herself practically full-time to teaching celestial navigation, as did Bart Bock. Shapley was often called away on matters pertaining to refugee scholars, such as committee meetings in New York to raise money to rescue people from Hitler's grasp. President Conant assumed the chairmanship of the new National Defense Research Council, with responsibility for projects pertaining to nuclear fission, and disappeared occasionally from his Harvard office to visit undisclosed locations in the Midwest and Southwest. Although half the telescopes at Oak Ridge shut down for lack of graduate students to operate them, the Boyden Station in Bloemfontein remained at peak activity. The new 60-inch reflector saw constant use, as did the old 8-inch Bache, the 13-inch Boyden, and the Big Bruce Photographic Telescope. July and August 1942 brought a spell of unusually fine winter weather to South Africa, allowing the Parises to break all their previous records of work accomplished. They had to stockpile most of the plates on site, however, until ocean transport again became safe. With no war-related assignments, the Gaposchkins stuck to their studies of variable stars. From the 20,000 variables discovered over the preceding 50 years of nightly all-sky photography, they chose 2,000 that had shone brighter than 10th magnitude at least once. Then they followed these target stars through plates dating back to 1899 and established the light curve for each one to classify the type of variation it displayed. They also checked back on some new stars to see what had become of them since their eruptions as novae. The star called U Scorpii, for example, which first called attention to itself as Nova Scorpii in 1863, had flared again, they found, in 1906 and 1936. Outbursts that made U Scorpii the first known recurrent nova. The plate collection had kept the 1906 news a secret for decades. The 1936 event had also gone unnoticed till now. Like an oracle, the great glass storehouse teemed with knowledge, but divulged it only when petitioners posed a specific question. In their long collaboration, husband and wife divided the kingdom of the variables roughly in half. Cecilia specialized in the Cepheids and other intrinsic